A big trade deal is celebrating a big birthday this year, and next week a diverse group of heavy hitters will be in the Valley to look at its past and future. Could a few days of discussion lead to action?
As odd as it may seem, those groups don't talk to each other very much. And so what I'm excited about is having a conversation that brings these groups together.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, 20 years of NAFTA at the Trilateral Borders Conference. Also, the political dominoes have started to fall as candidates gear up for potential congressional or other runs.
And sorry seems to be the hardest word, especially when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs in baseball.
We don't tolerate that from our third graders. Would they do something wrong? So why should we tolerate it from these guys?
Plus, hearing arts, and these boots are made for the bucket list.
That and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Senior officials from the U.S. and Russia had a marathon day of negotiations over Ukraine today. And as NPR's Ari Shapiro reports from London, there was no breakthrough.
Secretary of State John Kerry met with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov at the U.S. ambassador's residence in London. They spoke for 6 hours. Afterwards, Kerry told reporters that Russian President Vladimir Putin would not allow his foreign minister to negotiate on Crimea. On Sunday, people in Crimea are scheduled to vote on whether to join Russia. The West sees that vote as illegitimate, and Kerry warned Russia yet again that there will be consequences.
And everybody have said if the referendum takes place, there will be some sanctions. There'll be some response, put it that way.
World leaders have been vague about exactly what the response will be. European foreign ministers are meeting in Brussels on Monday, where the details may become clear. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, London.
India has joined the search for the missing Malaysian airplane. A satellite communications firm says it recorded ping signals from the plane long after it vanished from radar screens, signals that might help searchers. NPR's Julie McCarthy in New Delhi reports India's Navy is leading the operation to search for traces of the plane in waters between the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean.
In a statement Friday, India said two of its Navy ships, Coast Guard vessels, and aircraft are combing the South Andaman Sea. The Press Trust of India says the international search has shifted focus to the area amid reports that the jetliner may have flown toward India's Andaman Islands, northwest of the Malay Peninsula. Reuters news agency reports that the last military radar tracking suggested the plane was headed toward the dense tropical archipelago. Malaysian authorities have also asked India to search and expand in the Bay of Bengal. The widening hunt deepens the mystery of the plane's disappearance, and its possible diversion so far from the intended route has raised speculation of foul play. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, New Delhi.
In New York, officials say all the people reported missing have been accounted for in an explosion Wednesday morning that leveled two buildings. Eight people died, dozens of others were injured. New York City Fire Commissioner Salvatore Cassano says more than 60% of the debris has been cleared from the East Harlem site.
We haven't gotten into the basement yet. That's why as soon as we get all the debris out, we're going to send our marshals down and we'll examine any possible reason why, A, there was a gas leak, if it was, and why it ignited.
And he says they hope to get to the lower level tomorrow. Another sign of tame inflation, wholesale prices in the U.S. dropped slightly last month. The Labor Department says the producer price index dropped 0.1% in February. On Wall Street, it was lower territory by the closing bell. The Dow down 43 points at 16,065. The Nasdaq down 15. The S&P 500 down 5. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Coupled quick traffic notes to pass along on the 202 westbound Santan Freeway. There's an accident blocking the exit ramp at Higley. Also, I-10 westbound, an accident at Riggs. If you like what you see outside right now, you'll enjoy the rest of the day. Sunny skies with a high of 79. Sunny weekend as well with highs in the lower to mid 80s. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 77 degrees.
A man who's been convicted twice and tried three times for the same crime was sentenced this morning. Jonathan Duty has already been in prison for more than 20 years for the killing of 9 people at a West Valley Buddhist temple in 1991. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
This morning, Duty was sentenced to 249 years in prison without parole. He will spend the rest of his life behind bars because he was 17 when he killed the 6 monks, 1 nun, and 2 others. In order to be eligible for the death penalty, the perpetrator has to be 18 at the time of the crime. The now 39-year-old Duty was convicted for the first time in 1993 for the massacre. But in 2011, an appeals court overturned that verdict, ruling his confession was coerced. In October of last year, in his second trial, jurors couldn't reach a verdict. Then, this January, he was convicted in his third trial after his accomplice testified the crime was Duty's idea. He still maintains his innocence. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
There are now 2 lawsuits challenging Arizona's ban on same-sex marriage after a national gay rights group filed suit in federal court in Phoenix this week on behalf of 7 same-sex couples and the surviving spouses of 2 other couples. Mark Solomon, national campaign director for the group Freedom to Marry, says there are more than 50 such cases in 28 states, but he says the arguments are not all that different across the country.
They are similar, and they're similar to the argument that was the majority opinion that the Supreme Court made in last year when it struck down the so-called Defense of Marriage Act.
Solomon says that argument centers on the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. He says since that ruling, same-sex marriage advocates have won 7 court rulings, although they've been stayed pending appeal. His group's goal is to get a national ruling on this issue from the high court. But Solomon says even though there are suits around the country, Arizona's does serve a purpose.
As these cases sort of percolate up, there's no way to predict exactly how things will play out. So, you know, we want to see, first and foremost, for the people of Arizona, for gay couples in Arizona, that this law is struck down, this constitutional amendment is struck down in Arizona.
Meanwhile, Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn says he'll defend the law, arguing the issue is defining marriage, a task he says the legislature and the people have a right to perform.
The dramatic conflict in Ukraine continues. Secretary of State John Kerry says Washington and the international community won't recognize the outcome of the upcoming referendum in Crimea. Our partners at The World spoke with CBC reporter Derek Stoffel, who is in Sevastopol.
It is harder to see the pro-Ukrainians. They are out there. You know, it's hard to gauge them. But the pro-Russian messages are all over the place. But the Ukrainians, you know, they don't have the same organization and they don't have the same money. And also, they just don't want to go out because they've been roughed up when they've had rallies. So the pro-Ukrainian side exists. They're there. They support Ukraine, but they're not doing it nearly as vocally.
When you talk to people there, how are they expecting the referendum to go on Sunday?
Everyone expects that the vote will be for Russia. On the Ukrainian side, there's a lot of people who think the vote will be rigged. Talking to several Ukrainians supporters who say, what can we do? You know, they are going to win this referendum. And that's the big question then becomes, what do we do next? And that is the big question in terms of the uncertainty here. And the people I've been speaking to, I went to a bar the other night, met with some young Ukrainians supporting the Ukrainian side. One of the guys told me that he thinks he's going to have to move back to Ukraine. Another woman, you know, she's got a good job in Simferopol. She wasn't sure. So there's a lot of uncertainty on the pro-Ukrainian side. On the other side, you know, those who back Russia, they're excited. I just met a woman, an older woman. She said she's been waiting to cast her ballot for Russia for more than 20 years now. She's very excited about all this.
It's interesting. You mentioned the pro-Ukrainian person that you said back to Ukraine, but of course, Crimea is still technically part of Ukraine. But anyway, we've been hearing stories about an influx of Russian troops and material into Sevastopol brought over by Russian warships. Are you seeing any of that?
Absolutely. I can't say for certain that it was Russian vehicles, but leaving Simferopol this morning, there must have been, I counted about 18 vehicles, you know, big army trucks, the transport trucks, and couldn't exactly tell if there was troops in the back. But the main highway between Sevastopol and Simferopol, we saw this huge convoy, and we're hearing reports that Russian ships brought in more troops and supplies today here at this port. So we know they're here. In all, we've been told that there are about 30,000 Russian troops here, and that's you know, quite a lot more than the 6,000 that were based here before all this broke out, what, it's about 3 weeks ago now.
Now, one of the key things about Sevastopol is that Russia and Ukraine share a naval base. Is that sharing still going on, or is basically Russia taken over the naval base?
They've taken it over, and what they've done is they've basically, here in Sevastopol, they've forced the Ukrainians into their quarters. They're not allowed to leave. And the ships aren't allowed to leave. And I just want to tell a quick story. I spent the day on board another big Ukrainian Navy ship. This ship is being blocked. The Russians have actually sunk three of their own vessels at the entrance to the inlet, and so the ships can't get out. They prevented that, and that's meant, you know, these hundreds of sailors are now on their boat, humiliated. They're not able to leave, and they're faced with this choice. What happens if Crimea becomes Russia? Do they go to Ukraine, or do they join the Russian Navy? And all the sailors I spoke to the other day said, well, that's not even a choice. They're going to stick with their Navy. They've sworn an oath, and they're going to stick with Ukraine.
So, Derek, you say people there are really expecting the referendum to pass on Sunday. If it does, what do you expect is next for Crimea?
The biggest thing is the uncertainty, and we're seeing that in small ways. You know, the bank machine just outside the hotel where I am now, 10, 15 people waiting at that bank machine to take out money because they don't know they'll be able to do that after the referendum.
CBC reporter Derek Stoffel reporting on the pending referendum in Crimea.
The North American Free Trade Agreement turns 20 this year, and next week, representatives from the three countries involved will be in Phoenix to talk about it. The event is sponsored by the College of Public Programs at ASU, along with the University of Calgary in Canada and Tec de Monterrey in Mexico. Jonathan Coppell is the dean of the College of Public Programs.
What has emerged through the work of the organizing committee, which has representatives from all three universities, has been an agenda that reflects the interests coming from these three different places, and they're not the same. And so I think that the program probably looks different than it would look if it was something that we just put together unilaterally.
Is there anything that you've seen that surprised you so far?
I think that the thing that is most interesting is that the attitude is not one of retrospective judgment of whether this was a good idea or not, but rather a very practical focus on how do we address the shortcomings or the things that haven't worked as well as we might have hoped moving forward.
You mentioned that this is sort of a prospective kind of thing. What does it take in your mind to take something from a discussion like this among academics and other people and then put it actually into action?
So that's a great question, and we're really actually excited that only a week and a half after the conference, there's a follow-up event scheduled in Calgary, and we will have a discussion where the findings from our conference will be presented to a group of leaders from Phoenix and Calgary to say, all right, we've identified the following problems. How do we address those issues? How do we move past them? And we're planning a similar follow-up event in Mexico City.
Free trade, it seems, has become one of those issues, especially in national politics, that's gotten some controversy. How do you make sure that that doesn't sort of permeate and overtake the discussion that you're hoping to have?
Well, I think by focusing on the practicalities of trade, so for example, what are the logistical bottlenecks at Nogales, for example, that impede the free flow of goods, you get a little bit more distance from the big picture ideological conflicts that seemingly make it very hard to have a constructive conversation.
Do you think that there are lessons from NAFTA that can or should or have been applied to other trade agreements between countries?
Yes, I think there are always lessons. I think that one thing that the NAFTA sort of history shows, not just the implementation, but even the period leading up to the agreement, is that you can't just say everything's going to turn out okay, trust us. You actually have to articulate and think through how the agreement will unfold and where the benefits and costs will be felt.
I know this might be a question like picking your favorite child, but is there anyone in particular that you're most excited about hearing speak or getting to interact with?
What I'm looking forward to, is the interaction between the types of people that we've got attending. So we have public officials, we have business leaders who are in the trade sector concerned with logistics and so on, and we have academics who are experts on trade and relationships between these entities. As odd as it may seem, those groups don't talk to each other very much. And so what I'm excited about is having a conversation that brings these groups together. And if they see the status quo as being different than each other, well, that in and of itself is a useful part of the conversation.
Jonathan Coppell is the Dean of the College of Public Programs at ASU. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on your show.
The political dominoes have started to fall in this election season, especially when it comes to the state's 7th congressional district. Ed Pastor announced late last month that he would not run for a 12th term this fall. Today, State Representative Ruben Gallego resigned from the legislature in order to focus on the campaign. Another Democrat, County Supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox, is also expected to resign from her position. And State Senator Steve Gallardo says he too may step down from the legislature as he runs for the seat. Former Senate Minority Leader David Shapiro understands what those candidates are going through. 2 years ago, he had to decide whether to stay in the Senate as he ran in the primary for the 9th Congressional District. In a situation like this where it's clearly a Democratic seat, a safe Democratic seat, does it hurt the goings-on at the Capitol to have people who are ostensibly on the same team, in the same caucus in some cases, competing against each other in a primary?
Well, it certainly is a strain on their relationships with each other. Kirsten Sinema and I served for 6 years together in the state legislature, and we weren't just colleagues, we were friends. And I would say today are friends. We served on committees together, we worked alongside each other on many issues, and all of a sudden we're running against each other for Congress. And certainly it was a strain on the relationship. We've rebuilt that relationship and, you know, have become friends again, which is great. But it is difficult during that time frame.
What went into your decision to not leave the legislature? I mean, it seems like it's not a full-time job, but it kind of is a full-time job, especially during session. And at the same time, you're out trying to campaign for another office.
Yeah, I think there's a popular misconception about the legislature that it is part-time. It's part of the year. So there's part of the year that you're in session and part of the year that you're not. And while you're in session, it is a full-time job. It is a difficult decision, and you know, history shows that if you want to win the next job, a lot of times you got to leave the first one.
How much goes on behind the scenes of, if this person leaves leadership, I can do this. If this person decides to resign from the legislature, I can do this?
Oh, that definitely happens. And if you're not planning your next move and you're not thinking about it, the other guy is.
Is it weird to be a member of a caucus and then all of a sudden you have somebody new coming in, especially, and I say this respectfully, the Democratic caucuses generally are smaller than the Republican ones, so there are fewer of you to sort of know and get to know both professionally and personally. When you have one or maybe more new members come in the middle of the session, is it weird?
It definitely changes the dynamic. And when I was there, my last term in the Senate, I was the leader of the smallest caucus in the history of the legislature, 9 members. And when Kirsten left and David Lujan came in to replace her, there is a dynamic change. It's certainly more magnified for a smaller caucus, as you say. When you have 9 members, that makes a bigger difference. When a 35-member caucus has a change like the House Republicans, I don't think it makes as big of a difference.
Do you sort of work behind the scenes to try to get somebody up to speed? Is it possible to get somebody up to speed in a couple of months?
Well, unfortunately, a brand new member who comes at the last second and has to vote, for example, on maybe their first day in office, they're going to rely a little bit more on what others are saying when they cast their vote.
David Shapiro was the Senate Minority Leader in the legislature. He also ran for Congress in 2010. David, thanks.
Happy to do it.
State government isn't the only place affected by runs for higher office. The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors will undergo dramatic change when Mary Rose Wilcox resigns to run to succeed Ed Pastor in Congress. Wilcox has been on the board since 1992 when, ironically, she took Pastor's place. Michelle Yehi Lee covers Maricopa County government for the Arizona Republic. She says Wilcox has continued to play a big role on the board, despite being the only Democrat on the 5-member panel.
The fact that she is a senior statesman and that she's been involved in politics on the local level for so long has brought more power than most people would expect from a lone Democrat on the board. The board tends to work together on most issues. So she's definitely been able to get things done, such as a lot of human service issues, public health, and those sorts of topics have been very important to her.
How does her departure potentially affect the role that Andy Kanasik's going to play? Because now he'll become the senior statesman.
Andy Kanasik will be the lone incumbent, really, now. He and Mary Rose have served very important roles in the past year, mentoring the 3 new members and helping them navigate the world that is county government. So Andy will really be the only person who can give that institutional knowledge and be able to talk about how things have been done in the past and give guidance to the new members.
People might think of, let's say, the city of Phoenix. Huge city, has the city manager form of government. So members of the council are obviously important, but they also have to balance that with city manager. How does that work in terms of the power or the influence that the supervisors have? A lot of the chiefs of staff have been there for a long time. So if supervisors have something they want to do, how easy is it for them to have that influence and have that power for it?
At the county, it is a very administrator-driven place. Tom Manis, the county manager, runs the place. But ultimately, the supervisors, if there is anything they want to do, it usually gets done because they're the governing body of Maricopa County, the fourth largest county in the nation. And they set the budget for the rest of the elected offices. So they do have a lot of power, and everyone looks to the board for guidance, for priorities, for direction.
What's next for the seat that Mary Rose Wilcox has held for so long?
So after Mary Rose puts in her resignation letter, which could be any time between now and the end of May, really, the board will put out a call for people who are interested, and then they could go through an application process, or they could choose a different method because the time frame is so short. Her seat will be up for election later this year. Whoever is appointed to her seat has to run for re-election to serve the rest of her term through 2016. But the deadline to file to run for that seat is late May. So it depends when Mary Rose leaves. If she doesn't leave until close to that deadline, then the board is going to have to reassess how to pick the appointment and whether they run for the seat. All these things are being discussed right now.
Arizona Republic reporter Michelle Yehi Lee. Still to come, a pair of Valley art exhibits that appeal to your senses.
It's very clear to us that we are unable to distinguish our senses in this very elementary way that we describe to children as the five senses.
That's ahead. It's the show. Valley traffic at this hour. Watch out for accidents on the 202 westbound. That's the Santan Freeway. Accident is at Higley Road. Meanwhile, valley weather, except for a few clouds here and there, expect more of the same coming up over the weekend. Sunny skies and highs in the lower to mid-80s. Currently mostly sunny and 77 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum presenting Hollywood Costume. Nearly 100 costumes from a century of filmmaking, highlighting how costume design becomes a key component in cinema storytelling. Opening March 26th, phxart.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Sometimes technology seems to go terribly wrong.
The algorithm's actually quite simple. What I did was I created a top artist for every state based on the online plays and compared it to the online chart for the United States.
That's Paul Amer. He's a software developer at a place called EchoNest. His somewhat joyless but rather intriguing algorithm has produced a musical map of state-to-state online searches that he says shows the definitive musical identity of every U.S. state.
A state like New York, its most popular played artist might be Jay-Z. But if you look at the most popular artist that's played in New York as compared to the rest of the country, it's James Blake, which is quite a bit different than what you'd expect.
Okay, Paul's EchoNest map is kind of a head-scratcher. Intriguing. Feels a bit off, though. Maybe it's sort of like the state bird. Sort of right. Sort of, I guess so. Who can make a case for a state music without relying on an algorithm? We've got three candidates from three different states with three different state birds. John Richards is Associate Program Director and morning show host at KEXP in Seattle, Washington, where the number one pop artist, according to the EchoNest map, is the head and the heart. Joe Silva is an independent producer with WUGA in Athens, Georgia, where the map choice is future. And for Dave Campbell, host of the local show with The Current in St. Paul, Minnesota, where the map says the top artist is metric, an immediate controversy, like the dispute over the state bird. Is it the common loon or the mosquito?
We have two birds here.
And, yes.
So I think we're indecisive from the jump. And
Yeah, I don't know. As far as that map goes, metric, it's actually, that makes sense to me that people from Minnesota would buy more metric records than anywhere else. All the oceans boil and rivers play. But there's a whole lot more. I would say one thing that we are enjoying here that maybe people are just about to hear more about would be a rapper named Lizzo. Time's up. I'm jumping in the side, yo. Beside yo, this position knows so my yo. A child, yo, to a mountain making miles so. Gemstone, ain't got nothing on my shine, yo. A bido, the rules I make for Paho. Shut it. I done it, sun it. Minnesota transplant by way of Detroit, and she lived in Texas for a while. She teamed up with one of the producers from the Doomtree Collective, which is another thing that I would say probably is listened to more here than anywhere else in the country. And the two of them put out this record, and she is just pure and simple dynamite. She is just a force. She sings, she dances, she raps. I saw her play flute in this like 10-piece instrumental juggernaut called Dream Crusher. She just plays with everyone, finds her way to fit in with any type of music or any style of performer. But when she's on stage, you can't peel your eyes away from her.
Let's talk to John Richards, Associate Program Director and morning show host at KEXP in Seattle, Washington. Now, the willow goldfinch is the state bird of Washington, and I don't think I ever saw one when I lived out there. What would you say is the state music of Washington, bearing in mind that people in Seattle are very, very different from the people over on the eastern edge of the state?
You know, I've never seen that bird either. And if I were to have any bird be our official bird, it'd probably be a duck. For me, I grew up on the east side of the state. I live on the west side of the state now. It's so obvious. It's Macklemore and Ryan Lewis without question. Ow, I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a comma. This is awesome. You have Macklemore here in Seattle, Ryan Lewis from Spokane on the other side of the state. They've been true to their Northwest roots, playing benefits, coming back and playing free shows. And a lot like our world champion Seattle Seahawks, the state sort of adopted Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, not just the city of Seattle. And that's the only artist that jumped out as something you could honestly say everyone in this state is proud of and listens to all the time.
So how do you explain the map coming up with the head and the heart? Put your dreams away for now. I won't see you for some time. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind. Mama once told me, you're already home where you feel love. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind.
As a morning show host here at KEXP and a resident of Seattle, it's really easy to say head and the heart. I totally agree from my little bubble. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Go down to Ballard with all the beards and go into the bars and you're going to hear a little head and the heart. Those guys are great. They're on local label Sub Pop. Everybody in this city listens to them, from your indie rockers to your, you know, middle-aged dads to probably some grandmas and grandpas too. They're very popular here in Seattle. Now, if you were to ask me outside of Seattle, 20 minutes in any direction, I don't know if that's true or not. I would say it's probably not.
Joe Silva down in Athens, Georgia. That's another sort of music scene that is a bit of an island in the state. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. We are an oasis unto ourselves, for sure.
And the state bird of Georgia, as everyone knows, is the brown thrasher. So a lot of Megadeth and Anthrax there in Georgia.
I think we've sort of dispossessed ourselves of that fact just because I think the hockey team by the same name was so wretched that people are trying to downplay the thrasher.
So how much turbulence is created by the map choosing Future as Georgia's emblematic song?
I mean, you know, when you just look at this map as a whole, it sort of paints the country as, having musical tastes that are about as exciting as a roll of beige wallpaper, I'm sure that there's a fair amount of that being listened to, especially when you talk about down in metro Atlanta. But I think if you're honest about where Georgia is in the post-alternative world, the state is probably split across, sort of a tripartite axis of of indie rock, southern rock, and hardcore, you know, hip hop. The bands that draw the largest here in Georgia are bands like the Drive-By Truckers, who are sort of a good old-fashioned southern rock and roll band that can do what I think is fairly uncommon these days, is multi-day residency in the bigger cities here, and draw packed audiences for three nights, four nights in a row.
But you both go to jail for them four little babies you made and delivered along the way.
I just don't think that, you know, the post-college rock Georgia listenership is that easily defined.
Down with the map, man. Stop trying to put me in a box. I hear you, Joe.
Right.
Dave, John, and Joe, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Absolutely welcome.
You bet.
Three public radio musical voices there from Georgia, Washington State, and Minnesota.
The Takeaway is John Hockenberry in New York.
Have performance-enhancing drugs changed baseball forever? We're not suggesting a debate to stir up in the bleachers, although I frankly don't see anything wrong with doing that. It's a question four experts will discuss next week at an event put on by Zocalo Public Square. One of those panelists is writer Jane Levy. She's written biographies of Sandy Koufax and Mickey Mantle, among other things. So I pose the question to her.
It may have changed the perception of baseball by people who are so disgusted by them that, you know, they don't want anything to do with the game, though, of course, you know, what's the alternative, the NFL and concussions? Has it changed the way the game played? I actually, for the benefit of this conversation, went and checked some records, and back in 1998, you know, Sosa-McGuire year, when everything was so out of whack, there were 13 players who hit 40 home runs. Eight have now been linked to steroids. Last year, there were only two people who hit over 40 home runs. So has it changed it forever? No, the numbers are coming back down to the way the game used to be played. Whether it has changed how people feel about watching the game, I think that happened a long time ago, frankly.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, because part of your book about Mickey Mantle talks about sort of the lost innocence of that era. And I'm curious if you think that the innocence that we don't have now goes all the way back to that, or is it maybe more recent, maybe back to that 1998 season with McGuire and Sosa?
I think the loss of innocence, you know, started in the Garden of Eden. You know, Babe Ruth, who I'm trying to write about now, drank too much and he was not in shape. You know, the guys in the 50s gobbled greenies, including Mantle and all those great Yankees. Last year, when A-Rod came back and the Yankees played him, even though everyone knew he was guilty, there was an opportunity, if a club wanted to take it, to say, we're not going to tolerate this, we're not going to sanction it, and they didn't do it. The St. Louis Cardinals, which is one of the best-run organizations in baseball, paid Johnny Peralta, who served 50 games last year for steroids. You know, he gave him the sun, the moon, and the stars to play this year. So it isn't just players who are willing to, you know, make those kind of morally equivocal decisions. It's management, too.
Well, and you mentioned the St. Louis Cardinals, and a few years ago they brought Mark McGuire back as a coach. Barry Bonds we're seeing this year in spring training as an instructor for the Giants. Do you think that down the road some of these guys that maybe did it, maybe didn't, but have been linked to steroids, will they be sort of back accepted in the game?
Well, I think they already are. I mean, McGuire's the batting coach now in Los Angeles for the Dodgers. To me, it's very simple. If a guy comes out and apologizes and says, yeah, I did it, it was wrong, and none of this, it was wrong, but it wasn't really illegal and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was wrong. I did it. I'm sorry. If I could do it over, I wouldn't. and this is what I'm doing to persuade a high school student that they shouldn't do it either, then okay, you give them a second chance. But the pussyfooting sort of, well, I didn't really do it, and, you know, everybody else was doing it, you know, we don't tolerate that from our third graders. Would they do something wrong? So why should we tolerate it from these guys?
Jane Levy is the author of biographies of Mickey Mantle and Sandy Koufax, among other works. She'll be in the Valley next week as a panelist at a discussion asking whether PEDs are in baseball's past or if they'll be a part of the game into the future.
Mark and I like art. We may not always understand it, but we like and can appreciate it.
The problem, though, is that art and radio, not always a great combination. You know, art is so often a visual medium, and radio is, well, not.
But two Valley exhibits are basically tailor-made for radio, one at the Phoenix Art Museum, one at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, and we're going to visit both, starting at the Phoenix Art Museum. Except for footsteps and whispering and the occasional school field trip, the Phoenix Art Museum is a fairly quiet place. But the exhibit called See, Hear, Feel is changing that a bit. You might be surprised that the featured art form is photography. The artists are Christopher Churchill and Deborah Bloomfield. Jim Ballinger is the museum's director.
We're really kind of helping them challenge the boundaries, if you will, of photography, in that both are integrating sound into their, not the specific individual works, but into their installations. So in the case of Mr. Churchill, where he's photographing figures, he, on different wands, there's several pieces of his works, when you pick them up, you may hear the person who's pictured talking to you about themselves, a little bit about what's going on in the picture, and it instantly changes the way you interact with that work of art. Others have sounds of the work going on around them, etc., but they relate very specifically to the image that you're looking at.
Churchill's photos focus on faith with a small f, as Ballinger describes it.
This work by Christopher Churchill of John Wells, who's a truck driver up in Idaho. But these photographs, they have in common people's faith. And I'll use that as a small f, faith. Some is about religious faith, some is about other spiritual faith, other just faith in a system, faith in kind of life. You have a gentleman standing with a hat, plaid shirt, cowboy boots, you know, against his truck. Well, all of a sudden now you're hearing sounds of hitting off the metal, and all of a sudden it brings it more alive.
Could you and Andy compare him?
He's a winner. her son was the instructor. I'll take some more of that lemonade down there.
One photo that stands out to Ballinger shows a unique view of the Grand Canyon. It's similar to what you might see in Arrows on a Highways magazine. It, though, feels especially different because, strangely, it's silent.
So here's part of my fun about the experimentation of the show. When you have a piece where the person's telling you about the photograph, you tend to want to go there. So I'm wondering if Mr. Churchill hasn't played down the marvelous aspects of this great photograph of Grand Canyon, because it's like, well, where's the sound? Where's the sound? Because you want to be informed. And I don't think it's visitors being lazy to have the artist talk over their head. I think that it really does, as you read one picture just by itself versus listening to another, all of a sudden you step by, we watch people, they start gravitating a little bit to where the sound is, because there's a curiosity factor, particularly where we have a handset on the wall.
Do you want to do more with sound going forward with more exhibits?
Well, yeah, I mean, we would certainly do that. But in the last year, if you read the national press, you see that there's a lot of now that are almost taking this the other way, that the sound artists have let go of the visual side, and you're starting to see sound works right now at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. There are pieces up that deal with the senses and just total sound installations that you're seeing in, quote, what used to be called visual arts institutions. So the idea of art is shifting here in the 21st century.
Phoenix Art Museum Director Jim Ballinger walking me through the See, Hear, Feel exhibit.
Jim Ballinger referred to the exhibit at Smoke Up. It's called The Five Senses, and you hear it and see, smell, and feel it right away. The taste comes a little later. There are five pieces that make up the exhibit, but don't buttonhole any one of them into a particular sense. Some touch more than one, like Janet Cardiff's The 40-Part Motet, which you'll hear for the next few minutes. It's made up of 40 speakers in a circle, each playing one part of a piece of 17th century music. Claire Carter is Smoka's assistant curator.
It was intended to be sung as a celebration. It's a motet, so it's a prayer, and each of the 40 individual singers sings an individual line. And as the composition continues, singers in different parts of the oval where the circles are, where the speakers are arranged, sing and call in response. And the sound seems as though it swirls through the room as one speaker in a certain part of the area begins to sing and then another in another area.
You also have, for lack of a better word, an orange pyramid, literally a pyramid made out of oranges as part of this exhibit.
So usually you go into an art museum and you're not allowed to touch and you're not allowed to take things with you and you're definitely not allowed to eat them. But the artist arranged this artwork so that you could do all of those things.
Do you find that people, when they come to see it, do they actually take oranges? I mean, are they hesitant about like reaching out and grabbing a piece of art and taking it with them?
We find that children are definitely not afraid. This is one thing about the exhibition, which is that children intuitively understand the artwork. They don't get, they don't let their intellectual ideas about what an art museum means get in the way of them experiencing it. Their parents, on the other hand, get nervous and don't want their children to touch it. And part of the artwork is intended to be that negotiation between the person trying to understand what conventions they can break.
There's also a piece in which the artist set up 44 box fans in a semicircle. The wind that blows on the visitor is meant to recreate Walden Pond of Thoreau fame. And there's a 16-foot-high piece suspended from the ceiling filled with spices. The fifth piece is set apart from the rest. It's kind of like an indoor rainforest. Again, Claire Carter.
We have a very dark room. You turn down two corridors and your eyes adjust to the darkness, and you step into a room where there is a veil of water across the room and one single light, and it's a beautiful rainbow, and it's completely startling because your eyes are adjusting so quickly to the light, and you're allowed to walk into the room, experience the rainbow, experience the water. It's not just visual, you also feel the touch of the water, and the smell of the water changes the experience, the temperature changes, the humidity.
As you pointed out to me as we were standing looking at that piece, so many of these pieces are not just one sense. The water, you can feel it, you can see the rainbow in it, you can feel it when it touches you. With the oranges, you can look at them, you can smell them, you can taste them. So many of these pieces aren't just one particular sense.
Exactly. And in the writing about the exhibition, that became so clear. And I spent a lot of time looking at scientific research around sensory experience, and it's very clear to us that we are unable to distinguish our senses in this very elementary way that we describe to children as the five senses. And I hope that when people come in and experience the artwork, they will realize that it's a full body experience and that those things are made more powerful, the visuals made more powerful when you can see it or smell it.
The Five Senses will be at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art until May 4th.
See, Hear, Feel will be at the Phoenix Art Museum through March 23rd.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Trudy Maples, and I'm teaching a cooking class at my brand new kitchen studio. We do four consecutive recipes, showing them how it's made, giving them tips and ideas and things for cooking in the kitchen to make it easier for them. And then we serve them the recipe that we just taught them how to make. Everybody has to eat, and I think it's really awesome when you teach them how to do things at home and they get really excited and realize they don't have to eat out all the time. I think when you're inventing a recipe or creating, that it's really fun and challenging at the same time. Like, will this flavor go with this flavor? Will this go with that? And how's this going to turn out? Like the sour cream and chipotle sauce that we do for our halibut fish tacos. I had to make that 8 times before I nailed it, and it was so worth it afterwards. Okay, and then we're going to flip our pork tenderloin. Yum. See how it's getting all brown and nice on the bottom? We're just going to go on the back side and do the same thing.
Trudy Maples teaching a cooking class at her studio in Glendale. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just tasty, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, we wrap up our tour of the Phoenix Bucket List and look at items that have kicked the bucket themselves.
We do walk around rhapsodizing about a restaurant that's gone or something that was served at a coffee shop in the 70s, and most people, you know, let those things go.
That's ahead. It's the show. Pretty nice weekend on tap for the Phoenix area. Look for sunny skies with a high of 84, tomorrow 83 on Sunday. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s. It's sunny and 77 degrees at 2:45.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Gamage Beyond. Iko and Coma present Regeneration, a retrospective that transcends notions of time and space, creating theater from stillness, light, and sound. March 29th, 7 p.m., asugamage.com.
Arizonans exercise and eat fresh produce more than the national average. That's the finding from a new survey from Gallup. Michelle Scanzi with the State Health Department's Bureau of Nutrition and Physical Activity says the state is making progress in terms of healthy living, but still has some work to do.
We really like to look at both individual behavior and also those environments that may be more conducive for physical activity. So many of our initiatives focus on trying to get individuals to do that behavior change, whether it be going to the gym or eating fresh fruits and vegetables, in addition to doing the larger policy systems and environmental change, such as ensuring that our communities are designed to support physical activity and healthy eating, and that it's accessible for all community members.
Well, and you talk about healthy eating. Arizona actually does pretty well in that regard, among the top 10 as far as number of days eating 5 or more servings of vegetables 4 or more days a week. Arizona's right up there with some of the top states.
I think it's pretty easy to eat plentiful fruits and vegetables in Arizona. We harvest fresh fruits and vegetables every month of the year. And in fact, Arizona ranks 3rd in the nation for growing fresh fruits and vegetables. In addition, last year, Arizona produced nearly 98 million cartons of fresh produce. So as a state, we really make a good effort and good job at making it accessible for all Arizonans.
Michelle Scanzi is the community planner with the Arizona Department of Health Services Bureau of Nutrition and Physical Activity. We've been teaming up with Robert Pala and Amy Silverman of New Times on a list of things you've got to do in Phoenix before you die. We've been to Metro Center, Barrio Cafe, Kosanti, the Biltmore Tunnel, and the Japanese Friendship Garden. This afternoon, Steve and Amy go looking for footwear.
But not just any footwear, Mark. Boots. Cowboy boots, to be specific. I've lived in Phoenix for most of my life, but have never been tempted to own a pair. Amy, on the other hand, loves them, even though she got her first real pair in New York City.
You know, there's something symbolic about boots and how, I'm not sure what you can say on public radio here, but how you can kick some rear end in them. And I know when I'm teaching a writing class and it's the first night of class, or I have a big assignment or particularly a big interview, I will put on my vintage cowboy boots and I will head out with that in mind.
We met at Antique Trove in Scottsdale. It was on Amy's bucket list as a place to buy vintage cowboy boots.
We're outside right now looking at the window right here, and there's a lot of sort of Western-themed stuff.
I have to say there are a lot of representations on that wall of things that I grew up hating about Phoenix. So for me, this whole wanting vintage boots thing came about later, and it's, to me, a sign of having made peace with the place. You've got a cow head encrusted with turquoise that is absolutely hideous. You've got what I can only imagine is a slumbering Mexican in a sombrero in ceramic. I believe it's a vase. And then you've got two pairs of super awesome vintage cowboy boots.
Feeling inspired, we sauntered inside.
I believe you have some metallic ones there. Look at those silver ones.
Well, what appeals to you when you see a pair of boots?
Oh, I think they need to look like they've been well-loved. They can't be cheesy with a lot of appliques. They've got to have some stitching. I think cowboy boots are an extremely personal choice. For me, there can be no snakeskin or lizard or anything like that. I just want your straight-up leather with a little bit of detail on the sides. And if there were some flowers or stars, I would be happy.
As we slipped on some cowboy boots, Antique Trove's boot expert Sue Murphy came by to talk with us. She knows a lot. Don't be fooled by her Maine accent.
I can find them at yard sales. I've bought them from regular stores. I had a pair of them that were over there made while I was in Spain. They're pink, and they're black, and they have pink roses all over them.
You don't judge people based on that. Like, if you saw me and thought, boy, that guy has no idea how to wear a pair of boots.
I'd say it looks nice. Those boots look good with that outfit. Would you wear anything but boots with that?
If I could find some in my size.
Awesome? Yeah, it looks beautiful.
See if I can walk in them. These are 14E, Sue, which is not my size.
I didn't end up buying any boots, and Amy didn't either, at least as long as I was there. But she was eyeing some pretty closely, so she may have gone back. Whatever the case, we've tried on vintage cowboy boots at Antique Trove and marked off another entry of the New Times bucket list.
So we're now back in the studio with Robert Pala and Amy Silverman to wrap up the bucket list. And I want to ask you guys, now that you put out your 100 things and places to do and see in Phoenix before you die, what kind of feedback have you gotten? What have people said to you about the places that were on there, maybe places that other people wanted to have on there that weren't?
Steve wanted to know why there was so much food and so much shopping.
That's
on
a
there.
Fair question.
Because we live in Phoenix.
Because we were honest.
What else is there to do here? We eat and shop. But certainly people told both of us what was missing based on what they wanted to see.
You know, I didn't hear from a lot of people who wanted other things on there, but it did tend to do pretty well. Didn't you hear from a lot of people?
I did. I was surprised. I got a lot of email from both readers and friends saying, hey, I didn't know you grew up on the West Side.
I will say that for my final 10, I included quite a few things I haven't done myself. Line dance at the cash-in.
You guys, I don't think this is any surprise. This is even how we approached it. A little snarky, if we can use that word, with love, not pejorative. So when people hear about things like this, though, and even we'll get into some of the list of things you can't do anymore, people tend to be a little bit nostalgic, a little bit sentimental. Are those feelings that you guys are okay having yourselves and okay with other people having?
We're very sentimental. The two of us are two of the most sentimental people you'll ever meet, which I guess is ironic considering we're snarky.
Yeah, or maybe we are snarky because we're so sentimental. But that's the other thing is this is a project that we're sort of tailor-made for because we do walk around rhapsodizing about a restaurant that's gone or something that was served at a coffee shop in the 70s. And most people, let those things go.
So you guys had, 100 things on this list, but clearly there are some things that would have been on there had they still been available, right?
Absolutely.
We had to spend a certain amount of time creating these lists of things that we think that you should do and things that we have done. And it took a certain amount of time. And then, of course, we had to compare lists. But I found that the list of things that we can't do anymore took me about 3 minutes. At least my list did because, again, Amy and I are the sort, and maybe we're the only two who sit around saying, I can't believe I can't get surprise cake anymore.
Well, so, Robert, you said that it took you about 3 minutes to come up with this list. Which for you was more nostalgic, the things that you can still do, like going to Metro Center, or the things that you no longer can do?
Oh, always the stuff that is behind you forever. Not being able to go to Trulix for a drink. You know, there's a great deal of sorrow in that for me. And visiting the Wax Museum, which was one of Amy's items, as soon as I saw that, I went, oh, yeah. Our lives are no longer complete here.
One thing that got left off my list of places that aren't around anymore, and I woke up in the middle of the night and sat up and said, oh, no, the International Food Bazaar at Town and Country. That was super glamorous.
So what do these things on this list have in common, the things that aren't around anymore, other than the fact that they're not around anymore?
Well, you know, some of the animals at the zoo got old and died. So, you know, that's going to happen. Ruby the elephant's not around painting anymore, but nothing nefarious happened. She just died, as far as I know.
Are there any items on either of your bucket lists that you're particularly concerned in a decade, if you were to do this again, might be on the list of things that got away?
I'm really glad they saved Tovery Castle. I don't think that's going to be in any danger now, but I would have thought that a few years ago.
I think 10 years from now might be the best time to revisit this and find out what's gone and how things have changed.
I think there's such a movement now to save things that I would hope it won't be as bad.
Amy Silverman, Robert Pala, thanks for taking us on your bucket list, such as it was, a lot of shopping and eating, but thanks.
Thank you. It was fun.
It was fun. Thanks.
You've heard of the Lost Dutchman Gold Mine in Arizona.
Well, there's also a lost county, Ben. No, we're not kidding.
KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us one of the most famous cities in the world was once part of our state.
Did you know one of the world's most famous cities was once inside Arizona? In the mid-1800s, the territory had a county called Paiute. It was located in its northwest corner, which included Las Vegas.
The part of Nevada that we're talking about is basically that little point at the southern portion.
Michael Green is a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada.
Laughlin would be part of it. And then you go up to the Mesquite area. Essentially, you're going up the Colorado River. And the area was a lot greener back then.
In 1864, Arizona Territory originally had four counties, Mojave, Yuma, Pima, and Yavapai. A year later, the Arizona Territory Legislative Assembly voted to split Mojave in half to create Paiute County, named after a tribal group in the area. It was created to address a growing farming community, the expanding gold, silver, and lead mining industries, as well as a growing Mormon population.
There is some activity in the area, and having some form of government would presumably be a good thing for making sure that things are managed and at the same time maybe provide some offices to people who want some jobs.
But in 1867, Congress expanded the already established state of Nevada by adding land west of the Colorado River, which included part of Arizona's Paiute County. Arizona Territory tried to get lawmakers to overturn the decision. Some even launched protests against Congress. But it didn't work. When Nevada's southern border was expanded, Arizona's got smaller.
That meant that there was no longer a reason for Paiute County to exist, and there was no reason to keep it on the books.
So Paiute County dissolved about 4 years after it was created. What was left of the land in Arizona went back to Mojave County with today's existing boundaries. In southern Nevada, the Las Vegas area became Clark County. But get this. Historian Michael Green says in the early 1980s, it was discovered that Nevada's 1864 state constitution was never amended to include Clark County. For 120 years, the land surrounding Las Vegas was technically a no man's land. But Green says even though Nevada's constitution didn't acknowledge it, the federal government did. Nevada voters eventually got around to making the fix. It's The Show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
We want to know what you know. Send us a note. The Show at KJZZ.org.
Monday is St. Patrick's Day, but many people, like Mark, like to make it a whole weekend.
Except you're the only one among us with Irish heritage, Steve.
That's true. I do have thinning red hair, and I like potatoes.
The celebration of Ireland's patron saint is shrouded in myth, mystery, and traditions.
In other words, Mark Brody.
Pretty much, yeah. In Ireland, it was marked by a big feast, a reprieve from Lent.
But St. Paddy's Day parades really started in the U.S., the first one in
Boston
in 1737. Corned beef started here, too, when Irish immigrants in the U.S. bought cheap strips of beef, so that's what I've been eating, huh? And soaked it in brine to preserve it.
I liked it better before I knew that. Both of these Irish-American traditions can be found in abundance this weekend in the Valley leading up to St. Patrick's Day. One of the biggest events is the annual St. Patrick's Day parade and fair in Hants Park downtown.
Mary Moriarty is the operations manager for the Irish Cultural Center and chairperson of the fair.
I kind of kid that it's my little party for 5,000 of my closest friends. But when I see the little kids dancing and jumping up and down to the music and thousands of people having a good time, to me that's everything, because then that means we're passing on the culture to the next generation.
The parade starts tomorrow at 10. Sunday in Fountain Hills, they're dyeing the water green in the fountain for their party. Don't ask how they do that.
And on Monday, the actual holiday, the Celtic punk band Flogging Molly will perform at Tempe Beach Park. And a lot of other fun things going on this weekend, including the Kiss Me, I'm Irish Run. That's tomorrow from 7 to noon at the Westgate Entertainment District in Glendale.
There's also, I thought you were going to say something
else.
Well,
even if I weren't Irish, you can still kiss me. It's okay.
Thank you. The Liquid Soul Music Festival runs most of the day tomorrow at Sportsman's Park. That's outside University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale. Steve, I think some music from both yours and my past, the Gin Blossoms, Cracker, Everclear, more 90s-era bands. You can check those out tomorrow.
Mark, just to get this in quickly, too, and if you like when people stick their arms up your back and also tell you what to say, ventriloquist Jeff Dunham will be at the U.S. Airways Center. That's tonight.
We always want to hear what you have to say. Let us know what you think. The show at KJZZ.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make this week's show possible. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.